This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Matthew Miller, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Yehuda Mirsky about his new book, Rav Kook, Mystic in a Time of Revolution, originally published by Yale University Press in 2014, with the paperback coming out in 2019. A powerful original thinker, Rav Kook combines strict traditionalism and an embrace of modernity, orthodoxy and tolerance, piety and audacity, scholasticism and ecstasy, and passionate nationalism with profound universalism. The little known in the English-speaking world, his life and teachings are essential to understanding current Israeli politics, contemporary Jewish spirituality, and modern Jewish thought. This biography, the first in English in more than half a century, offers a rich and insightful portrait of the man and his complex legacy. Yehuda Mirsky clears away widespread misunderstandings of Rav Kook's ideas and provides fresh insights into his personality and worldview. Mirsky demonstrates how Kook's richly erudite, dazzling poetic writings convey a breathtaking vision in which the old will become new and the new will become holy. Yehuda, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Matthew. And thank you very, very much for having me. I genuinely appreciate it.
Yehuda, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Me? Okay. Well, my name is Yehuda Mirsky. I teach at Brandeis University in the Department of Near Eastern and Judaic Studies and in the Schusterman Center for Israel Studies. Though I teach at Brandeis, I live in Jerusalem, and so, fly with some regularity. I'm originally from New York. I grew up on the west side of Manhattan. I always hastened to add the pre-gentrified west side of Manhattan. Grew up in sort of a world of humanist orthodoxy. My late father, who was named David Mirsky, was a rabbi and a professor of literature at Yeshiva University and an administrator there for his entire life. And over the years, I've sort of been my intellectual life and professional life is one that sort of tacks back and forth in many ways, between Israel and North America, between Jewish studies and larger, larger, but other areas of inquiry. I mean, I did my BA in English literature. I did a law degree and worked for a number of years in Washington. On Capitol Hill and in the Clinton administration. I was in the State Department's Human Rights Bureau. Then eventually I did my PhD in comparative religion. And I did a few years of coursework in Arabic and Islamics before heading back to Jewish studies in general and Rav Kook in particular. And so I also straddle a lot, the worlds of theory and practice and of politics and religion. And I guess one of the reasons I find myself so drawn, have one of the many reasons I found myself so drawn to working on Ralph Cook for so long is that precisely because he's such a large and eclectic figure in terms of who he is, in terms of the things, the areas on which he touches, in terms of the things that he was writing on and so forth.
Thank you very much for that. How did you come to write this book?
Well, it's a funny kind of thing. I was first, you know, it only took me, you know, however many decades. I first became really aware of Rav Cook's writings in the late 1970s when I was studying in yeshiva on the West Bank in Gush Etzion, the Etzion block in on the road between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. It's a place with rather large history. One of the heads of the yeshiva was my late teacher, Rabbi Yehuda Mital, who was an important interpreter of Rav Cook's thought. Growing up, one had heard a bit about Rav Cook. Once I started working on him over the years, I discovered there were many more familial connections to him of my own than I'd known when I was growing up. But, you know, in the circles in which I grew up, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik was the great culture hero. You know, sort of the great Lithuanian scholastic Talmudist with the PhD in neo-Kantian philosophy. And Rav Cook, sort of, you just knew he was this sort of religious Zionist, poetic, mystic type or something, but he wasn't much on the radar. And then for a variety of reasons, in the course of my first, even as early in my first year of study in the yeshiva in Gush Etzion, 1978-1979, I became exposed to the writings of Rav Cook and was just very captivated by them. By the theology of culture, by this remarkably expressive poetic language with which he developed to write about his religious experiences and to think about modernity, for his ability to see the large spiritual currents pulsating not very far from the surface of secular culture, which in many ways resonated very deeply with this Orthodox humanism in which I was raised. But to be perfectly honest, something we'll be talking about, you know, part of what makes him interesting and controversial are the ways in which he is seen as the spiritual godfather of the settler movement in Israel. Certainly its religious wings. I mean, to this day, much internal discussion within the settler movement goes off on what would Ralph Cook have said about this or that, even though he died in 1935. And during those years, I was very taken with that. I was, I would say, a fellow traveler of the messianic wing of the settler movement. And I was very taken with that. So I remember one day in like somewhere in the years between 1978 and 1980, one afternoon, I was just gripped by the sense that one day I was going to have to write this man's biography. Then it sort of, you know, so he was always in the background. He was always in the background. He was always hovering not far from things I was reading in literature or philosophy. Though over time, the other religious thinker, theologian who came to influence me very, very deeply was not Jewish at all. It was the Protestant theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr. Part of what I began to make my own political journey, so to speak, from right to left with regard to settlements and much else. But Rav Cook stayed with me for the moral pathos, the universalism, and part of what's so striking about him as a modern Jewish thinker, it's hard to think of a thinker who's one at the same time as nationalist as he is and as universalist he is. And so when I was working in the State Department of the Human Rights Bureau, a lot of what he did was very inspirational for me. So it was a long time in coming, but the immediate impetus was sometime around 2009-10 or so, Professor Steve Zipperstein at Stanford University, who's editing this series for Yale University Press, the Jewish Live series, reached out to me and asked me if I would want to try my hand at a brief biography of Rav Cook. I often say that it reminds doing a brief work about Rav Cook, it's like the Monty Python sketch about the All England Summarized Proust competition, you know, where you have to summarize all 8 volumes of Remembrance of Things Past in 30 seconds or something. But but we tried for it. We went for it, and somehow it, thanks to the patience of a lot of people, it came to pass.
We've been referring to the subject of the book as Rav Kook, and the title of the book itself is Rav Kook, Mystic and Time Revolution. So, of course, the term Rav means rabbi, but I'm curious, was this your decision to refer to him as Rav Kook, and why would one do so?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, it was my decision. For several reasons. Part of it is simply the man's rabbinical stature and place, such that certainly in Israeli circles, even secular Israelis, almost nobody calls him Kook. Someone's referred to as Rav Kook. And indeed, I mean, we'll talk about it further, perhaps much what I was trying to do in this book is sort of take a lot of what's like a very central figure and set of questions and concerns in Israeli intellectual and cultural life and sort of transpose them into an American English key. Part of it, frankly, came from my own background. Yes, I'd freely admit, you know, I still have great reverence for the man, and it would have been hard for me simply to call him Kook. When one of my doctoral advisors at one point balked on my referring to him as Rav Kook in the course of my dissertation, I said, well, if I were writing about St. Thomas Aquinas and I called him St. Thomas, I imagine that wouldn't be a problem, would it? And he said, he thought for a second, he said, he may have said, I guess not, you know, wouldn't be a problem as long as you're consistent about it or something like that. So that's the reasons are a mix of the principled and personal, I guess.
So we mentioned before that this is part of Yale University Press's series, Jewish Lives. So had you previously read other books which had come out in the series? Was there any sort of structure they had to make sure the book fit in, or was it quite broad?
I mean, my book was actually it wasn't one of the very first in the series, but it came out fairly early on, so there weren't many to choose from. I think I may have read one or two more. I would say like this, the idea was to try and write the way I conceived of it, was to write a book-length essay on the man that would be, on the one hand, interesting and accessible for people whose knowledge of Jews, Judaism, Israel would come from like book reviews in the New Yorker or something like that. But at the same time would be sufficiently interesting to have something to say to people who've been working in the vineyards of modern Jewish thought and Rav Kook studies for a long time. There had been no, because he's such a large and complicated subject, there are very few biographies of him. The last attempt of someone to write a serious scholarly biography of Rav Kook was the late Jacob Agus in 1946. And he actually did, you know, in retrospect, he did a very good job with it. But that was it. Even in Hebrew, we still don't have a full-length biography, academic scholarly biography of Rav Kook. There's like scores and scores and scores of volumes. And there are some other books that are like mine in that they are brief one-volume biographies. But a full-length biography of him currently doesn't exist in any language. Perhaps another time we'll talk about a book that I recently published that attempts to be, so to speak, the first volume of that. But the idea, what was interesting here was also there was a literary challenge. And the literary challenge was to craft a kind of idiom in which I'm talking about somebody who was a vital, dynamic mystic, who has elements of his thought that are also highly rationalist. And also that I'm not just talking about his ideas here. I was also very much in my background, the years that I spent working in politics and so forth, came to play in this book because I spent a good bit of time talking about where he fits or in the political and social processes in early 20th century Palestine and so on. So the challenge was to write, to develop an idiom, a literary idiom, where I could talk about this mystic, this you know, intensely passionate religious mystic with an incredibly active public presence and public life, and to try to create a language in which I could talk about him both from the inside out and the outside in, where I could try to convey what are his mystical experiences and visions and philosophical and theological reflections as they are, sort of like to catch them in mid-flight in his mind, while at the same time being able to step back and situate them, situate those theological flights, situate them in the larger arc of Jewish intellectual history and in the concrete social and political realities of his time. That was a real challenge. At the beginning, I'll tell you, I was struggling with it a lot. I couldn't figure out how to do this. And then for some years, I used to write book reviews for The Economist, London. And my editor was a wonderful historian and journalist named Anne Roe, W-R-O-E, Anne Roe. And when we were still in touch over the years, and at one point she sent me a book that she'd written that was a biography of the poet Shelley. And I took it with me on a plane somewhere, and I read the first 50 pages of it. And there was just something about the style in which she wrote that unlocked something in my head. I didn't go ahead and write a book about Shelley. I didn't write a book stylistically, I didn't mimic her style because her book throughout is very imagistic and so on, much more than mine. But it was just, I'm mentioning it because I'm sharing, because some of our listeners might find it interesting just to hear how I was able, to the extent to which I was able, to sort of crack this particular conundrum, this particular thing that I've been having trouble with in terms of getting my writing started. And once I read those first 50 pages from Anne Roe's biography of Shelley, like I said, it just something unlocked in my head and I knew I had to sit down and write.
I'd love to go back to what you mentioned before and also to the title of the book. So Rav Kook, you referred to both in this conversation as well as in the book title, you referred to him as a mystic. And I think many people have an intuitive understanding perhaps of what mysticism is, perhaps not, but how would you define, what is your definition of mysticism and of a mystic?
Right. Well, it's a funny thing, A, because the word mystic itself is related to the word mystery, right? So it's a sort of thing, you know, once you've defined it out of existence in some ways. And also, mysticism is this term that's, I mean, there are religious traditions that use the term, obviously in Christianity, use the term mysterium to talk about specific patterns of thought and religious engagement. But of course, this term mysticism, in the way that we use it, is of course, we use it in a very modern way, the same way we use these modern categories like religion and myth and symbolism and so on to talk about things, to talk about people of different times and different places, and we're using terms that they themselves didn't use, right? Rav Kook never called himself a mystic, right? He did that term isn't in his vocabulary. I mean, he knew about the word mysticism because he was reading things, but I mean, and of course you know, there is no such thing as, I mean, as many scholars have noted for decades, there's no such thing as like a free-floating mysticism, you know? I mean, Jewish mystics don't have visions of the cross, right? And Christian mystics don't have the spirit of the Mishnah come and study Torah with them and so forth. So what do I mean? So by calling Rav Kook a mystic, A, I'm meaning to indicate his very profound relationship to the Kabbalah, to the Jewish esoterical, theosophical, we'll call it mystical tradition, which is very, very, very central to his thought world. Now, it's important to note that the Kabbalah is very much an intellectual tradition as much as it is a tradition of anything else, right? Much of the Kabbalah is as densely textual and richly conceptual as any other facet of Jewish culture or history. And also the specific Kabbalistic schools out of which Rav Kook arose, just to say Lithuanian Kabbalism was one that made a point of maintaining a highly scholastic character, which is to say that in this case, you know, mysticism does not mean the abandonment of reason. It's a way of channeling thought and crucially experiencing thought. And experience brings me to the second feature of the term mysticism here that's very, very important. Rav Kook is someone whose religious experiences, religious experience is kind of like a pretty pale term to describe sort of the intensity with which he went about things. But he's someone for whom his experiences of ecstasy, of illumination, of understanding, of making sense of himself and his time are central to his thought world. And also experience is central to his understanding of the human condition. One of the most arresting insights I ever heard about Rav Kook, I heard it years ago from a wonderful scholar named Shlomo Fisher. He's a sociologist and intellectual historian here in Jerusalem, and his long-awaited magnum opus on Rav Kook's thought and religious Zionism is hopefully going to come out in the next year or two. He put it really, really well years ago when he said to me, you know, Rav Kook was able to talk about an extremely modern kinds of subjectivity and personal experience and sound them out of the deepest recesses of Jewish tradition, Talmud, Midrash, and Kabbalah. And so much of what Rav Kook's ideas are about are recognizing and validating his own experiences and the experiences of other people. Right. So, I mean, this sort of gets us over finally a bit to some of the substance of his ideas, if I may. You know, Rav Kook, he's born in 1865 in the Western, in Lithuania, the Western edges of the Russian Empire, is in the throes of modernity, reform, reaction, revolution, all these things. The Russian Revolution is just a few decades away. He is a member of the rabbinic aristocracy, not by birth. He's not from a terribly noble or well-born family, but by virtue of his sheer talent and attainments and so on. He's on one side of his family, he's from a very scholastic, intellectually minded family, and the other from a Chabad Hasidic family. Like so many people, he's preoccupied by, you know, the collapse of traditional Jewish life and community all around him. And tries to make sense of it and tries to articulate some sort of response to it. And what sets him apart from his rabbinic peers is his ability and willingness to recognize the subjective experiences of people rebelling against him and all he represents, and doing so in the name of ethical, moral, communal-minded passions that he sees as good and in some sense divine. And so this notion of bringing the truth out of oneself, the idealistic truth out of oneself, is for him a central feature of the human condition and world history. So those are the different ways in which this term may be unartful or anachronistic of the word mystic for him, was this attempt to ring together these things, where he's the spiritual traditions out of which he's working, the kinds of experiences that he's having, and the importance that he lays on subjective personal experience in his picture of the world, even when talking about very large political and social movements around him.
So we spoke a bit about some of the material that he used to develop his mystical experiences, his mystical persona, Mishnah, Talmud, the Kabbalah. So I want to dig a bit more into that. So what exactly were the sources that he was studying, both traditional sources as well as perhaps more modern sources that allowed him to develop into who he was?
One of the things that's remarkable about him is how well-versed he was in practically every branch of Jewish learning. I mean, it's just, you read him and his texts. I mean, part of what makes Rav Kook a very interesting scholarly field is that in his theological writing, which mainly comes out of his spiritual notebooks, most of the time he doesn't tell you what sources he's quoting or working with in his head. So there's some indices, and also after a while you sort of have a sense of things. But once you start tracking him down, I mean, it's part of the fun of the detective story of it is that he's just read an astonishing amount of material and has like a phenomenal memory for it. So what do I mean by that? Bible, Talmud and its commentaries, medieval commentaries and modern, halachic literature. You know, centuries of, because also for much of his life, he's a working rabbi. He's a rabbinic judge. He's answering questions all the time on points of Jewish law. So the library of rabbinic judicial opinions. The Kabbalah, of course, you know, the locus, the great text of the Kabbalah, the Zohar, but many other Kabbalistic texts, especially the works of Moshe Chaim Luzzatto of the 18th century, the Ramchal, the various works of the Lurianic corpus, the Kabbalistic works of Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the works of Lithuanian Kabbalah, 19th century Lithuanian Kabbalah, but also part of his intellectual equipment is, and this was something that I discovered in the course of my research and one of my hopeful contributions to scholarship on Rav Kook has been trying to make the point of the centrality of the medieval philosophical tradition to his work. I mean, when I started really digging into Rav Kook, I never thought that I was going to have to be reading up on technical points in the philosophy of Maimonides and similar medieval rationalist philosophers, but they were just there. They were just there. And also seeing them in Rav Kook, I began to see how medieval philosophy lived on in rabbinic circles in Eastern Europe much longer than we thought. And at times there's ways in which the intellectual scaffolding of a lot of his issues comes from questions and debates in medieval philosophy on which he then builds in Kabbalistic terms. But also, and this is one of the things that's really interesting, it's the question that almost everybody asks me when we talk about Rav Kook, is how much non-Jewish stuff did he read? Because he clearly did. There's thinkers who he mentions by name, right? Nietzsche, Schopenhauer, Kant, that sort of thing. He doesn't mention Hegel all that much, even though he's very Hegelian, right? Tends to stay away from Krochma, the great Jewish Hegelian, even though he's sort of clearly read a lot of him. At times he's read Hermann Cohen, he's read William James or read about William James. He's also read literature. The thing is, he himself did not know any European languages, but he didn't need to. The Hebrew and Yiddish periodical culture of the late 19th, early 20th century was remarkably rich. If you go to the website of the National Library of Israel, nli.org.il, there is a section there, a database, I think it's called Historic Jewish Press or Historic Jewish Newspapers, where they have PDFs of newspapers in Hebrew and Yiddish and Ladino and Arabic and English and French, you name it. And you look at them and it's just, it's amazing how much was being written in Hebrew and Yiddish, including in quote unquote Orthodox publications about the intellectual and artistic and cultural trends of the day. there were books, there were digests of philosophy of Western thought being written in Hebrew, to which he had access, which we know he had access to. The example I always give for his knowledge of Western culture and thought is that imagine you knew an ultra-Orthodox yeshiva boy who didn't spend a day in his life in university, but had a number of friends who did, with whom he talked, and who would regularly go to the library and read through the latest issues of, you know, the New York Review of Books and that sort of thing, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And was remarkably creative. He would have some very interesting things to say. You wouldn't necessarily go to our imagined ultra-Orthodox yeshiva student if you wanted, like, you know, the state of the art interpretation of the thought of Immanuel Kant. But if you were to ask him, tell me, what do you think about the thought of the ideas of Immanuel Kant? You might hear something very, very interesting. And that's very much the case with Rav Kook. Also, if we take a look specifically at the philosophers or the philosophical currents and schools of thought that he seems to swim with in modernity, they are the ones which, like the Kabbalah, were very influenced by the heritage of Neoplatonism. So he's really in dialogue with, like, German idealism and, you know, Hegel and Schopenhauer and so on. But somebody like David Hume is rather foreign to his thought world. And the one other thing I'd have to say about philosophers is, of course, Spinoza, who, like so many modern Jewish thinkers, he's fascinated by Spinoza and comes back to him again and again from all kinds of directions.
So to get back to the issue of translation, so we said that Rav Kook was able to understand so much in translation, which I think is something we've seen throughout history. Maimonides himself was someone who was able to get so much knowledge from works in translation. So just to think about translation from your perspective. So translation was something that you had to do a lot of when writing this book, because as you said, a lot of the material of Rav Kook was not yet in English. There were some translations of passages, certainly, but a lot of the work of Rav Kook was not yet in English. So what was the process like for you of translating this work? Were there any particular passages that were difficult? In general, how was the process?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because he's hard. I mean, because he's a poet. And how do you convey? So there's a bunch of different things that I did. First off, one point that I make, and this is a typographic point, is that when he's, quote, at times he has a passage, and he won't say, as is written in the book of Leviticus, da da da. He just, like, will insert a line from the Bible or from the Talmud or from the Zohar in the flow of what he's writing. So when that happens, I italicize it. When I could identify it, I italicize it. Just to give a hint to the reader that this is an illusion going through his head. Something else that I did, and frankly, this is where my undergraduate training as an English major came in handy, because he's striving very hard for a certain kind of poetic idiom. And he's striving very hard for certain kinds of poetic effects. It's kind of interesting that when Rav Kook actually sets out to write poetry, like with stanzas and meters and stuff like that, it tends to be very wooden and didactic and not terribly successful. It doesn't really get off the ground. When he's not trying to be quote unquote poetic, but just sort of writing what his theological musings are, he achieves stunning literary effects. One thing that I did in terms of Bible translations, when I would consult, double check Bible translations for things, I not infrequently would go to King James. Because I guess I'm a sentimental old fool about King James. But also there's something about these like archaic, elegant sonorities of King James that was helpful in capturing the voice of this man who sees himself as speaking out of, out of the long duration of God's revelation. There were some passages that were very hard to do, some passages where I would simply leave the Hebrew in and then sort of put in parentheses trying to explain what I hoped it meant. And I think the only way to do something like this is also to be, as a translator, extremely upfront about the limitations of your translation. I mean, a different book, a book that I just translated much of, is a book my wife, Tamar Biala, just published a book called Dear Shuni, Israeli Contemporary Women's Midrash. And it's an anthology of midrashim, midrashic writing done by contemporary Israeli women, which she published in two volumes originally in Hebrew and now in English with Brandeis. And I translated the Midrashic text. And at the beginning, I wrote a preface sort of telling the reader, believe me, these texts are much more powerful in the original than I'm able to convey. And I think if you're working as a translator, it's very important to try to do that, to be upfront about that.
Thank you. That's very insightful. If we go back to the beginning of the book, even before the text of the book begins, we have a couple quotes. So there we have one quote from Walt Whitman about contradictions. And then we've got a statement of Rav Kook, a translation, of course. It says, our only resting place is in God. So I want to just understand why. Why did he choose these quotes and how does it set the stage for the rest of the book?
The quote from Whitman is Whitman's very famous, do I contradict from Song of Myself, right? Do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. So Rav Kook is this figure who is jurist, poet, mystic, communal leader, deep nationalist and deep universalist. He is as erudite and concerned about the most intricate minutiae of Jewish law as he is with the most far-reaching ecstatic visions. Right, he is somebody who, from four square within the rabbinic fraternity and power structure, affirms some of the most revolutionary currents of modernity. Right, he has passages where he talks about, the spiritual level of socialism, the spiritual level of anarchism as being a higher of socialism. Right. So there's all these contradictions in there. And so parenthetically, years ago, I began to notice some sort of strange stew that bubbles in my head. I began to somehow think of Whitman and Rav Kook as somehow not dissimilar to one another in certain ways, bearing in mind and controlling, of course, for the many, 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 many differences between them. And then I actually saw a line from none other than Gershom Scholem, the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, where he said he sensed certain affinities between Rav Kook and Whitman. And I thought, well, hopefully I'm not that far off. But Rav Kook's sense of contradiction is very much rooted in his I am large, I contain multitudes. As far as he's concerned, God is big. God is huge. So God can't, really be restricted to any one mode, any one voice, anyone, right? And so God speaks through all the forms of idealism and all the religions and all the arts and all the cultures and all of that. And the I am large in Whitman speaks to his sense of himself. Part of Rav Kook's thought is theorizing about his own experiences. Here I am, right? Here I am, this like really, you know, authority laden rabbinic figure. And I see something very godly and divine about these revolutions in the name of social justice, right? I often say sort of, he never put it quite in these terms, but his argument with his rabbinic colleagues would, you know, his rabbinic colleagues, of course, despised all these secular revolutionaries who were turning the tables on them. These Jews who are abandoning tradition and doing it in the name of Zionism, socialism, and all of that. And his argument to them would be like, you know, my beloved colleagues, these people are not rebelling against us so that they can go eat pork chops and cheeseburgers. They're rebelling against the Tsar and they're being sent to Siberia. They're going to Palestine and clearing swamps. And what's more, they keep saying that we don't care enough about the Jewish poor and the Jewish masses and Jewish suffering, and they're right. They say our religious ideas are antiquated, and they're right. Now, he doesn't join them. What he says is like, because I can see how they're right, and I can see how the tradition is still right, and if I can work out some synthesis in my head, then maybe I can also translate that synthesis into institutions and do something in the world. So those two quotes, right? I'm also part of why I quoted Whitman was also because Rav Kook is in many ways a shockingly free spirit in the ways that Whitman is. And yet for him, when he writes our final resting places in God, he can go as far as he can. He can let these tempestuous whirlwinds of modernity swirl around and through him because he has this faith that in the end, it all winds up in God in this like great cosmic, you know, resolution of harmony, whether one thinks he's right about that or not. That's how he sees things, to my mind.
So Rav Kook is, as you just said, a man who is very complex, who's full of contradictions, has many different views throughout his life, even at one particular time. And I think to some degree that could lead to people having not necessarily understanding him because he's got so many different aspects to him. And we said at the beginning as well that there are many misconceptions about Rav Kook. So just drilling in there, what are some of the misconceptions that people have that you hope your book clarifies?
Right. Well, you know, I always say, and I say this at the outset of the book, you know, if you usually say Rav Kook, right? I mean, sort of like there's the incredibly simplistic misconceptions, right? Rav Kook, oh, he's the rabbi who said you should love everybody. Oh, he's the rabbi who said you should hate Arabs. Or put a little more, you know, usually what people know about Rav Kook is that, you know, if they know something, they know, well, he was the founder of the modern chief rabbinate, first Ashkenazi chief rabbi and the founder of the institution of the chief rabbinate, as we know it in then it was pre-state Palestine, now it's state of Israel today, and that he was sort of very much seen as the foundational thinker of the most important, he wasn't the first, but the first most important thinker of religious Zionism. And I would say that those aspects are true, but they're in some ways the least interesting things about him. So he is this founder of the chief rabbinate, which when he started it, he was not a reform Jew. He thought that changes needed to happen in Jewish law. He disagreed very much with how the reform movement was going about it. He thought that change needed to happen as out of like an organic process of redemption, of divinely guided of the Jewish people in concert with the rest of humanity in the land of Israel and so forth. And he thought that, you know, this rabbinate that he was creating would sort of help be sort of like a conductor of that eventual spiritual revolution. Of course, that turned out very much not to be the case. Most crucially, right? His son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, was the spiritual leader of the vanguard of the settler movement, starting a little bit after 1967, but more importantly after 1973 in the Yom Kippur War. And Reb Tzviuda said that, you know, that he was simply putting into practice his father's teachings, and if his father were alive today, this is what he would tell us to do. And Rav Kook's, so much of, and so people then assume that that Rav Kook's ideas translate very in a one-to-one correlation into contemporary religious Zionism in all sorts of ways. And then, you know, even including religious Zionism's excesses, right? Last week, just last week, one of Israel's major television networks, Kan 11, Channel 11, had an hour-long primetime documentary about Rav Kook and his legacy, which essentially, towards the end, laid the blame for the Rabin assassination at his doorstep, which I think is inaccurate, though I could understand why the person said that. So there's a lot of misconceptions there, but also even the fact that my choosing to write about him in a very biographical vein, and also unlike most of the most of the students of his thought, okay, I wouldn't want to call myself a scholar. Most of the students of his thought, or scholars of his thought, and I'm one of the students, usually don't discuss his thought developmentally, right? In my work, I very much trace the evolution of his ideas over time. Now, if you're looking for somebody to be an authoritative canonical figure from whom you always get the answer about what you're supposed to do and who never changes his mind, that's not the way to look at it, right? And some people have problems with my doing that. I think there are any number of people and many people in Israel for whom Rav Kook still needs to be this authoritative figure, and his canon needs to be read, you know, in a way such that it can brook no contradictions. But one thing that I say in very much in the Israeli context, where these things are very alive, I don't take a side on whether or not Rav Tzvi Yehuda was right or not in interpreting his father's teachings. He had to interpret him. His father died in 1935. Tzvi Yehuda lived for decades afterwards and had to face a different reality. I think we all, to the extent to which we and clearly his father, the elements that Tzvi Yehuda saw in his father's teachings are quite there. I think when you're working not as a quote unquote dispassionate scholarly observer, if there is such a thing, but if you're working with an authoritative religious figure and their ideas as a guide to action in the present, I think that how we decide to interpret the figures we deem authoritative is itself a moral choice, and we have to take responsibility for the moral and ethical dimensions of the interpretive choices we make.
You said that Rav Kook's thought has changed over time, that he thought certain things at an early period of life, perhaps he changed certain opinions. So just as we're closing, as we're thinking about Rav Kook and his thought, so in what way, so we saw that he moved to Israel when he was almost 40 years old. And of course, he had a long period before that. And you've got another book which really covers that period, which will lead to a separate conversation. But if we look at his period in Israel, how did he change? How did he develop once he got to Israel and became the rabbi
as you said, I worked on this for a long time. There were some elements of continuity. Things like an interest in subjectivity and expressivism was there before. He was always, for him, the relationship between the Jewish people and non-Jews of goodwill was something that always intrigued him. The relationship between Jewish morality and universal ethical morality and the ways in which they can support one another interested him from the get-go. Amazingly, in light of his life after he moves to Palestine, what's amazing is the absence in his early writings of the land of Israel. It's just not there. I mean, it's there in the same way, like in any self-respecting rabbinic figure, the land of Israel is going to show up and all of that, but it's not a category of thought, and it becomes a category of thought. And also, once he's in the land of Israel, he's tending towards a somewhat messianic reading of modern history before, and that emerges full-blown, right? He comes to have eventually no doubt that he's living in messianic times. He gives himself entirely over to he sort of gives himself in one of his journals shortly in the first notebook that he keeps after moving to Jaffa in 1904, he has a line in there where he talks about himself as the kind of person whose God has fashioned in such a way as to make him receptive to ideas and thoughts and sensibilities from people all around him. And there's this way in which he was an open-minded person before, but there's ways in which he sort of radically opens himself up to the people around him, including his opponents, and is willing to sort of stand in and absorb the gusts of feeling and commitment that are swirling around him over time. But there's ways in which his thinking during World War I becomes a bit more apocalyptic, understandably. His thinking about rabbinic institutions changes. When he's early on in his years in Palestine, he's the rabbi of an important city, but of one important city, Jaffa. And he's wants he supports the authority, the autonomy of local rabbinic courts, even as he's trying to build a network. When he becomes chief rabbi, he has these ideas of a much more centralized authority, right? He becomes of a piece with other state and institution building efforts done by the Zionist movement. And then, of course, there's a big question with him as the last decade of his life. Much of his writing from then still has yet to be published. And his writing then, you know, as the 1920s wear on and become the 1930s, messianic redemption seems not quite as close at hand as it did before. There's starting slowly in 1929, the riots of 1929 and the increasing mounting Arab-Jewish violence, which he tries, you know, which he grieves and which in his way he tries to stem somehow or not give into, but he has a very hard time with that. And there's this more muted quality to his thought over time. So those are some of the changes that he undergoes.
Thank you very much. There's so much that we could go into, and we could go for hours, we can go all night, but I think that so that people buy your book, and also so we make sure that the podcast episode is a good length, I think we'll close there with the questions about the book, and we'll move on to the traditional New Books Network question. Please tell us, what are you working on now?
Okay. Well, it's a great question, as always. Two things. One is, as you mentioned, I've also written about a book about Rav Kook's early years. It's much longer and much more, quote unquote, academic in many ways than this book, you know, platoons of footnotes and, you know, lots of dangling modifiers and qualifying phrases and things like that. So I'm trying to work on a Hebrew edition of that. I've done a Hebrew edition of this first book, and which got, you know, a surprisingly nice reception here in Israel. And I'd like to take a break from Rav Kook for a while. I'm sure if we could ask him in his heavenly abode, he'd be glad, relieved to know that this odd American is letting him off for a while. And my next projects, I hope, will be focused on sort of some of the other areas of like very profound interest to me that I mentioned earlier, political thought, human rights, the deep ties and tensions between human rights and theology and nationalism and liberalism. And I'm actually thinking of writing something about the post-war years of the late 1940s. And when so much of the world order that we see coming apart today took shape then. And as of now, that's kind of what I'm thinking of or hoping to do if I live long enough.
Thank you so much. We have been talking to Yehuda Mirsky, author of Ralph Cook, Mystic in a Time of Revolution, originally published in 2014 and published in paperback in 2019. Happy reading, my friends.